This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Konstantin von Hofmeister. We're going to start with his recent essay on archaeofuturism. Konstantin, it's great having you back on the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
And I'm also joined here with Brandon Adamson.
Hey, guys.
Brandon, didn't you run a site on Konstantin's national futurism? And what was your interest in that topic?
Yeah, it's still up at nationalfuturism.com. A couple of years ago, or maybe even longer than that, I came across a lot of Konstantin's old writings from 2004 and 2006, and a lot of them were kind of in line with my views, so I thought it would be a good idea to get permission from him to compile all of them and into a site so that they would be up continuously, so that other people could find them in like a cohesive way.
And Konstantin, archaeofuturism is a term coined by the French intellectual Guillaume Fay. Is there any connection to national futurism?
Well, I wouldn't say. Yeah, I guess there is a connection because, well, both are concerned with the future, first of all, and they have sort of like, I would say both have a lot of like science fiction elements to them, and both are utopian in nature, and both basically describe the Faustian principle in action, or how the Faustian principle could be employed to achieve future greatness for the white race.
And can you explain what you mean by the Faustian principle?
Well, you know Faust.
The old German story about the man who sold his soul to the devil?
Well, basically, yes. Well, you have several adaptations. Like Christopher Marlowe wrote a play. Goethe, the German poet, wrote a famous play based on the Faust legend. And quite interesting, my parents live in southern Germany, and the town of Knittlingen is about 20 kilometers away, or 20 or 30 kilometers away, and that's actually the historical Faust town. They have a Faust museum, so the historic Faust supposedly lived in this small village, so they have the Faust archives there, where they collect like all kinds of manuscripts related to the Faust legend and all the different adaptations that were published all over the world. And yes, well, it's the idea of one man selling his soul to the devil to achieve greatness, which is somehow related also to the legend of Prometheus in Greek mythology, who stole fire from the gods to give the fire to mankind, or the same principle also in the Bible with a serpent that convinces Eve to then convince her husband Adam to eat from the forbidden tree to the fruit of knowledge, to gain knowledge, and therefore as a result they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden, but they gained knowledge and therefore, I don't know, propelled evolution forwards. And it's the same idea with Faust, I suppose.
I never understood why, even as a kid when I read parts of the Bible, like, I never understood why it was a bad thing that they ate from the tree of knowledge. It was almost like it's better if you remain ignorant and dumb. I mean, maybe that's like can be seen as being better for society, but it's kind of like I think it was good that they ate from the tree of knowledge, and that's ultimately it's almost like it teaches people that they should leave themselves in the dark and not really concern themselves with trying to know more and increase their understanding of the world.
Well, I think it's like they were meant to eat from it, because like the whole point was that God said, you know, it's like, okay, you can do whatever you want in the Garden of Eden. It's paradise. You can run around naked, you know, I don't know, make love, play with animals, and eat everything you want except the fruit from this tree. You can't touch it. It's not allowed. So, I mean, he already gave them the temptation. Of course, they were going to eat from it eventually. And I think, you know, God pretty much, like, if there is such a thing as God, like, he counted on humanity to actually try the fruit, to therefore become independent of him. So maybe he or she or it wanted humanity to become independent. So
right, why would you want people not to be curious, you know, to just give up their curiosity and just, I don't know, that's just my take on it.
I think it's pretty much everybody's take, because the whole idea is you can have blind obedience to a supreme being, or you can be independent and become a supreme being yourself, which is, and also somehow related to the whole idea of Lucifer being a good guy instead of being the bad guy, because he rebelled against God's authority and wanted to assert his own authority, and therefore was also
right,
like kicked out of heaven and cast to earth, and you know, became Satan and the devil and so on. So I mean, you have like Anton LaVey, you know, the Church of Satan builds on this, because I mean, it's the Church of Satan is basically like the whole idea that humanity is the supreme being and not God. It's not about sacrificing babies, but asserting the authority of man, basically, over the authority of a supreme being who might not even exist, and therefore goes against the whole principle of blind obedience, which is what all Semitic religions usually teach.
By the concept of the Faustian spirit, you're talking about man becoming godlike on Earth?
Well, of course. Well, yeah, I would say so, because if man... Well, man has the potential, I would say, to become godlike, but only if man finally, I would say, propels himself off this planet and starts colonizing the galaxy, meaning other planets, and maybe terraforming them, and thereby spread his seed, so to speak. And then, I would say yes, he becomes godlike, because then he has total mastery over the cosmos. And that is a whole idea, because what's the point of existence? I mean, I would say in Western man, the whole point of existence was always like the striving of going further and further and exploring, developing yourself, and thereby aiding evolution, the evolutionary process. I think it's also in line with... Sorry?
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, even getting away from the term a god or godlike, it's just about trying to strive to beyond the limits of what humans can do, and constantly trying to expand our knowledge of the universe and what we can actually do and learn, as opposed to just staying, in a sense, stagnant.
Well, I agree. You know, it's like I was just reading William Pierce the other day. I know you're familiar with William Pierce of the National Alliance, and his whole idea of cosmotheism, because it's pretty much also in line with archaeofuturism, because he also talks about Godhead, and basically the whole point of existence is to serve evolution. And well, William Pierce championed the cause of the white race for evolutionary purposes, because he believed that the white race was the most advanced branch of the human race and therefore should sort of take a leading role. And well, according to him, they shouldn't, the whites shouldn't mix with what he termed, like, say, lower races, but they should basically perfect themselves, and they will also eventually become one with the universe, or one with the cosmos.
Do you reject Julius Evola's view of a spiritual concept of race?
Yeah, it depends how you define spiritual race. Like, how would you define it?
Well, there's this concept that there's these spiritual principles that transcend race.
I know what you're talking about. So, because Evola talks about, like, I would say, like, the aristocratic principle of race, like the whole, like, say, spiritual Aryanism that is sort of like independent from biology. And he says that it's like the spirit is more important, and how you carry yourself. Yeah, I'm not so sure. It's a bit abstract and a bit philosophical. It's very hard to apply in the real world, because like what does he exactly mean by this? Like, okay, so you have like some primitive redneck type in America. He would not be considered Aryan, but then you would have, they say, for example, a Nigerian who's very well read, philosophical, is very honorable, and he would be considered Aryan, or like more like your spiritual racial kinsman. I find the idea very dubious, and I reject it because I'm a materialist and I believe in matter, first of all, and therefore I believe in the biological definition of race more than the spiritual one. And without a basis in biology, we can't have any grounding in spirituality. So I would say, like, matter comes first, and spirituality comes from matter. So I would say I'm more in tune with Karl Marx on this issue.
You articulated this very well in an essay called Racial Bolshevism, right?
Yes.
Where you kind of talk about how Evola's, like, concept of a spiritual race is really just kind of like a confusing abstract. It's almost like just a mumbo-jumbo, because the spirituality actually stems from the workings of the brain, which is matter, and it's going to vary according to the organism that it belongs to. So this whole abstract concept of it is really kind of almost a distraction.
Well, it's mental masturbation, really.
Right. I believe that you used the, if I was going to quote you, you said that metaphysics should be secondary to physics, just like mental masturbation should be secondary to real sex, right? Physical sex.
Yeah. But, well, I believe that's pretty much what I said in the essay.
How does Guillaume Fay define his concept of archaeofuturism?
Well, just to put it in a nutshell, I think the whole idea of archaeofuturism is like the, like I would say, like the fusion of archaic traditional values with progress, like technical and scientific progress. So basically, he says that, in opposition to people like Alexander Dugin and maybe the Eurasianists or even national anarchists who want to sort of like revert back to a more primitive age, a Western man, Guillaume Fay says we should not reject technology, we should not reject science and progress, we should embrace it, we shouldn't be afraid of it, but at the same time we need to remember where we came from, our traditional values, our heritage, so to speak, our archaic traditions. And we should somehow fuse the two, we should follow the path of progress, but sort of like armored with tradition, so we don't lose our way, our ethnic or our racial way, so to speak. And yeah, and I think he doesn't even reject things like transhumanism or the creation of chimeras, like hybrid species or like man machines. It's not necessarily a bad thing, because it's going to happen anyway. So, because if it's going to happen anyway, whether we do it, whether the Chinese do it, whether the Russians do it, whether some other race does it, it's going to happen. So if we do it, we should do it the right way, so it can support us in our struggle for survival and expansion.
Our cyborgs will be wearing togas.
I think Norman Lowell, if you're familiar with him, he lives in Malta, he wrote a book called Imperium Europa. Are you familiar with
right.
him? Anyway, yeah, he had the idea of like cloning people, and I was like sort of tongue-in-cheek, like cloning some famous Spartans or some famous Romans to support us in the future struggle. So it tongue-in-cheek, but you know, it's like the idea is valid, because cloning will be a reality, or already is a reality, so we should deal with it constructively.
Well, the book Archaeofuturism, it was written in the 90s, and it takes place in Europe in the 2020s in the near future. What kind of future does GamFi describe?
Yeah, well, he sort of describes like a sort of a two-class system, almost like an apartheid system. Well, he says that his vision of the future for Europe is like, okay, so you have the Euro-Siberian Federation, which includes pretty much all of Europe and Russia, including Siberia. And he says that in the future we'll have, like, I believe very few, like, mega cities, like fairly big cities with, like, very advanced technology, but only very few. And the vast majority of people will live in the countryside, in villages, agriculture, and the people who live in the countryside will not have any access to advanced technology. They will be almost like revert back to the Middle Ages and will be very superstitious, that they will worship the seasons and almost become sort of like neo-pagans who till the soil, while all this, like, I'd say, like, the elite will live in the cities and they will have all the knowledge, the technical knowledge, and they're the ones that lead the Federation, the Euro-Siberian Federation, into the future. And he says it's necessary to have a society like this because of the ecological disaster that will happen soon. And to avert another such disaster, we cannot all live in cities, we cannot all consume technology and resources, therefore only an elite can do it. And I understand where Guillaume Fay is coming from, I understand his idea, but I'm not sure I think it's a good idea, and I sort of almost reject it, because in my opinion it's not feasible, because such an apartheid two-class system will eventually, in my opinion, lead to some sort of revolution, almost like the Bolshevik Revolution again, because who decides who's part of the elite and who will not be part of the elite, who will have to live in the countryside. And if you live in the countryside, but then you find out about the elite and you want to join the elite, but then you're not allowed to join the elite, then what's going to happen? So you can see that the seeds for future conflicts will be sown with this whole idea if it's ever going to be put into practice.
It's like when you have like situations like South Africa, where people arrogantly think that this small group is going to be able to indefinitely rule over these millions and millions of vastly superior numbers, and that they're just eventually those people are going to want to revolt. They're going to want they're going to want to assert their own will and have a piece of the pie. Like, I think you're not going to be able to maintain that indefinitely. I think that was one of the big problems with a lot of colonialism, is that they just assumed that they were going to control these huge territories where they were vastly outnumbered just because they were more advanced at that particular time.
Yeah, I think colonialism is a bit more complicated, because if you look at India, for example, I believe I'm not sure about the exact numbers, maybe like 100,000 British people that ruled over 300 million Indians for several centuries. And it's not like the British people were kicked out because, like, these hundreds of millions of Indians all of a sudden asserted themselves and became violent towards the British. So it was more like the British pretty much gave up because of World War II. So it became shameful to be a colonial because of the Nazi legacy and racism and so on. So I think they just gave up. But I think, like, if things had turned out differently, they probably would have been able to hold on to it and probably still rule India today. I mean, theoretically speaking.
But you could make the same case for South Africa. If they had the political will, they could have carved out their own country, but the whole political trends were going against colonialism, and the Europeans there decided to vote against apartheid.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's it. Because there was just lack of will. But it was not. It was not like lack of numbers. It's not like they were overwhelmed by, like, I don't know, millions of blacks that all of a sudden threatened them and were going to kill them. So in the end, again, they just gave up, like the British did in India. But they didn't have to. That's my whole point. You know, it's like, because there was simply no will. And
to put it another way is that when you have that many people and you're colonizing some far off place, they don't really have to to kill that many people or cause very many problems for the people back home to start thinking that the whole thing just isn't worth it. So they don't necessarily have to wipe everyone out, but it's if you're in the home country and you're sending troops over there to constantly put down these tiny rebellions, and your sons are being killed over there, then at some point you're going to just be like,
yeah, but that's not.
This isn't worth it. I mean, the Indians did have revolts against Britain.
But most of the troops that the British used were like Indians, anyways. Like they had to, in the colonial troops, they had a bunch of whites and a lot of Indians. So it's basically Indians killing other Indians for the British crown. And it was very profitable because it was a huge market for British products and so on. So I think it was profitable for Britain, but it was also profitable for the Indians, like the Raj, the jewel in the ground, the colony that the British established there, because everything the Indians have today, starting from the railroad, the school system, the legal system, the language, the infrastructure, all the cities like Bombay, Delhi, Calcutta, they were all built by the British. So for example, if the Indians change the names now from Bombay to Mumbai, it's very disingenuous because it wasn't Indians that actually built the cities, it was the British.
With Fei's book, Archaeo Futurism, does he talk about the role of Islam in Europe and demographic trends?
Well, of course, you know, because that's what's going to lead to a disaster, according to him, because he talks about the convergence of catastrophes. Well, he has a separate book with the same title, and he says...
So one book is a science fiction book about the future, and the other book is a collection of political essays?
Actually, I think the book Archaea Futurism is both, like only the last part, like the last chapter. It's a short story. The first part is a theoretical groundwork.
I've read snippets of Archaea Futurism when it was posted on different blogs, and there's also some Google documents of it, but I've never read the book in its entirety. So you're saying it's a combination of philosophical and political essays and the science fiction story based on Europe in the future?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah, that's what it's about. Well, and he wrote several books. Like, he wrote another book just only about Islam, which I read a couple of months ago. And he just talks about Islam. According to Fei, Islam is the number one problem that Europe faces at the moment, simply because of the numbers of immigrants that are coming in, which are Islamic background, and also because Islam is very aggressive, and the most Muslims don't want to assimilate. They're very reluctant to assimilate, and therefore they're basically like a real invading army, sort of like an occupation force almost in Europe, that he completely rejects. And he doesn't want him to assimilate, he just wants him to go back to where they came from. And that's why he's also in conflict with people like Alain de Benoist, who's another famous, I would say, French philosopher from the New Right.
Alain de Benoist an assimilationist?
No, he's not an assimilationist. I mean, he believes in ethno-pluralism. As far as I know, he says that pretty much we have to accept the fact that there are millions of, I don't know, foreigners or people of foreign races in Europe, and it's according to Benoist, he says it's completely unrealistic that we'll be able to kick them out at some point in the near future. Therefore, we sort of like have to live together with them, but we don't want them to assimilate. We don't want to become like sort of like America's a melting pot. Everybody becomes American and everybody becomes the same. So the cultures and the ethnicities, they need to. Sort of stay separate. So he basically wants to form enclaves within Europe, like say a Muslim enclave, a Chinese enclave, or say a white French enclave, which can sort of like communities which exist in the same territory but separate from each other, and each community does its own thing and celebrates its own heritage and its own culture and its own traditions.
Based on your personal observations in Europe in the last decade or so, what have been some of your observations and trends, and are you pessimistic about the future of Europe?
Well, I would say I'm completely pessimistic. I see no hope whatsoever for Europe. If you look at what's going on right now, so Germany, for example, you had the election this year, and or less here, the AFD, but about 13%. So, and the AFD is pretty much, well, I would say the AFD and the NPD are the only two parties in Germany now that actually are somewhat opposed to immigration or uncontrolled immigration. But the NPD is pretty much dead. I think it got less than 0.5% in the election. And the AFD, I believe, got about 13%. So, which tells me, and a lot of people celebrated this, they said, 13% is great, you know, it's wonderful, wow, it's amazing. But if you look at 13%, yeah, it's okay. But at the same time, it means that 87% rejected the AFD, which means that 87% of Germans or German voters are completely okay with immigration. They have no problem with it, because all the other parties pretty much support and promote uncontrolled immigration. And they say so openly on television, so it's not like the German people are somehow duped into it. You know, it's like into voting parties that they don't know what they're voting for, because they know exactly what they're voting for, because none of the parties are trying to hide it on television. And it's the same in France. So Front National lost again, Marine Le Pen lost again, which didn't surprise me, because apparently the French also like it, you know. And in Britain, there's no nationalist party at all who opposes immigration. Like, UKIP is not against immigration. I can't think of any party in the UK right now with any kind of influence who's somehow against this uncontrolled immigration, which is also happening in Britain, which is happening everywhere in Europe. And yeah, if you can change it democratically, how can you change it? I don't know. I don't see any way out at the moment.
Is it just the numbers of current migrants, or has Merkel talked about increasing the numbers even further, including family reunification?
No, family reunification is happening. They already said it. So you can say for every so-called refugee that came last year or 2 years ago, they'll probably get, like, I don't know, a wife, maybe two wives, maybe three wives, as it happened before, and several children. So it'll be like times three, times four. So they invited in 1.5 million. It'll be like 5 million maybe. But then at the same time, I think what I've just read last week, they're still letting in about 30 to 50,000 every month on a regular basis, new ones. So it'll be lost like over 500,000 every year for the next couple of years. Well, just from a demographic aspect, the migrants have more children. They'll make more babies than the Germans. So I would say Germany will be like one-third foreigners very soon, if it is not already, and then one-half in maybe 10 years, and then it's too late anyway. It's like the point of no return will have been reached if it hasn't been reached already.
Isn't that kind of like, I mean, Robert and I have talked about this on the show before, like, isn't that kind of the big hole in this the strategy that these people have of, like, oh, we've got to win over the masses and the normies, where, like, the demographic ceiling is just too low. You know, like, in France, like, you can win over tons of people, but at the end, you know, 30% doesn't get you anything. 40% doesn't,
yeah,
really...
It means nothing.
You don't get anything.
You must get 51%, or it's nothing. Because only if you have 51% can you decide policy. Even 50% is not enough, because then the other 50% will just completely reject you and refuse to collaborate with you, and you won't be able to push anything through. So basically,
judicial and like legislative obstacles. There's like judicial and legislative obstacles. So you need like 70%. Actually be able to ram your agenda through. Like,
I would say absolute minimum is 51%, preferably more, of course, but that's completely unrealistic for any kind of nationalist party. I mean, if they got 13% now, the next election will be in like 4 years or 3.5 years. I doubt they'll go from 13 to 50. Maybe I think they'll just stay the same, like 13, maybe 14, if nothing happens. And then it's too late, because because every year more and more people are coming in, and a lot of these people are going to get, I would say, German citizenship, which means they will be able to vote in future elections, and none of them will vote for any kind of nationalist party like the AFD. So I guess it's the same problem in America with the Mexicans, because the more Mexicans are naturalized, the more Mexicans that can vote, the less chances you'll have of ever getting a Republican president again. Not that it means anything getting a Republican president, as Trump.
Right, even when one wins, you know, like Trump ran on kind of as like a civic nationalist platform, but I mean, he won by a paper thin margin, and he can't even get through the most minor parts of his agenda.
Yeah, he can.
I mean, because you need to have a huge majority in the Congress, and then you have the judges. like you can't just be like, oh, I won the election. It's just, that's not enough. You need like you need like 70 or 80% of people to actually be able to actually push things through that are controversial, because there are too many ways that they can be thwarted. Any countries in Western Europe that you think are have the best chance to survive in Western Europe? Like maybe they have like natural geographic barriers that make it less attractive or for people to settle?
Well, Western Europe, I don't know. I would say Austria now, because Austria, like, I would say the Austrians pretty much elected sort of like a right-wing government, sort of semi-right-wing government into power, which I don't see happening anywhere else in Western Europe, and say East Germany as well, because the AfD got almost 30% in East Germany, which is pretty impressive. So, and then you have Western Europe. I can't think of any country, to be honest. Like Central Europe, yes, like Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia. Yes, these countries, because they're actually opposed to what's going on in Western Europe, and the crisis is deepening within the European Union because they pretty much refuse to play along with the refugee game and the redistribution game. So I pretty much only see hope there. I would say Poland, Hungary, maybe Czech Republic, maybe Slovakia, say the Romania even. Yeah, but not Western Europe. Western Europe, I would say Austria, maybe, and maybe East Germany. If maybe they have any chance of seceding from the Federal Republic of Germany, that would be a good thing.
Is this part of the reason why you were interested in space travel?
Well, I'm interested in space travel because it's the ultimate goal. It's like the only noble goal that is left, because everything else on our planet has been explored, has been done. We can't really discover anything new. So we have to go somewhere else, so which means we have to leave the planet, you know, to be true to the Faustian spirit that we are born with, that we are endowed with. So it's basically like fulfilling our race's manifest destiny.
The thing is, the planets like Mars, they lack the natural resources. Are you talking about searching for distant planets that might be like another Earth?
Yeah, but that's very, well, that's of course, I would say, unrealistic at the moment, because they're too far away and we have to locate them first, and it would take a very long time to get there. So I was thinking about like maybe just establishing bases on Mars, maybe some other planets, and thinking about terraforming, like making the planets habitable, which is also a long process, I suppose. But it needs to be done in the long run for the race to succeed, to be successful, and to persevere, because I see no future for us, or for humanity in general, on our planet, just because of environmental degradation and overpopulation. There's no future. Climate change, maybe.
We have all these issues like climate change, environmental degradation, but those other planets, they basically have hardly any natural resources. There's no oxygen, water. Aren't we better off? That seems like it would be a lot more difficult, trying to create a civilization from scratch on Mars than to try to save this planet.
Well, we can do both. We can try to save the planet and create other civilizations on other planets. Because, like, again, like Norman Lowell says in his book, and I've been saying for a while, because what about meteor strikes? Like, the danger of the Earth being struck by a meteorite, and everything will be wiped out if a meteorite's big enough, like the dinosaurs, we'll all die. So basically, we need to keep our options open. We need Plan B. We need several inhabited places. So if one gets hit by a meteorite, the others will survive.
Yeah, and even if like we did everything possible to save this planet, you're still dealing with the inevitable reality that the planet will eventually be destroyed when, you know, as the sun gets larger and changes in the sun and other natural changes that have nothing to do with us, like comets, meteors, and things like that. It's inevitable that the Earth will someday be destroyed. So even if that doesn't occur for millions of years, it may take us millions of years to to build up a civilization in the solar system and out of the solar system. So, like, we might as well get started now. Like, why would we wait, you know? Like,
well, that's my point, yeah. Why wait? No reason to wait. And why waste so much money on useless things, like useless wars that nobody benefits from, if you could colonize the galaxy instead? Because they always say NASA doesn't have enough money, the Russian space program, they don't have enough money, because they constantly have to spend all the money on new weapon systems to threaten each other for no reason
at all. Yeah, for the amount of money that we spent in Afghanistan and Iraq, we could have had a city on the moon by now.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been...
It is for the trillions of dollars. Literally. Yes.
Yeah.
It's insane.
I mean, not only that, but besides space travel, imagine the amount of infrastructure we could have invested in if we didn't have these ridiculous wars.
Right.
But didn't Trump say that he wants to stop wasting money on wars and he wants to build the infrastructure? I don't see it happening, because all he ever talks about is, like, the military budget now.
Right, he wants to restore, like, the 1980s military budget. Like, I don't get it. It's just kind of like,
I don't understand. He wants a military parade now, so okay, nice. Right.
Yeah, Trump has become one of the... I mean, his ideas, he sounded good in the beginning, but he's become one of the biggest jokes.
Well, it's comical though to watch people who, like, it's comical to watch people that are kind of in the alt-right that are still, like, twisting things to, like, to make it like a 4D chess. I mean, that's become, like, almost a joke right now. Like,
they're making excuses for hiring John Bolton and all that.
Like, here's what he's really trying to do, guys. Like, just so you know, don't get worried. Like, here's what he's really doing here. It's like, it's just total bullshit. Like,
yeah, I don't see it happening. Where's the wall? There's no wall. There's always talk about prototypes, and I don't know, like some other people said yesterday on Facebook. Yes, a prototype is a great thing. A prototype of the wall is a great thing to keep prototypes out. You know, it's like, but how do you keep out illegal immigrants? Like, when are you going to build the wall? Okay, I understand you can't do it because there's too much opposition. But if you can't, if a president gets elected on a certain platform, but then the president actually can't do anything, he can't implement any of the ideas that he promoted during the campaign, what's the point of even having a presidential system, of even voting for a president? He's useless either way, whether he wants to do it or doesn't want to do it. It makes no difference if he can't do it. You know, say, well, who cares if it's 4D chess, 26D chess? Apparently he can't. I don't know if he wants to. Maybe he wants to, maybe he doesn't want to, but apparently it makes no difference because he can't do it anyway.
Yeah, and they're going to, I mean, he's running, he has no time now because he had his first 2 years to do that, and now they're going to have the 2018 elections. And the Republicans are going to get wiped out in the Congress, so he's going to be able to do even less of his agenda. He was going to be labeled a pariah anyway, so he might as well have just, like, tried to push through his agenda anyway. He's not going to get any favors in the media by doing this other stuff.
Yeah, I would like to know how many people he's deported to, because I remember him saying during the campaign that he wants to deport all the illegal immigrants. Like, what does he mean? What did he mean by all? 11 million, I suppose. So, I don't know. According to this plan, he should be deporting, I don't know, hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands every week. But all I ever hear about is, like, a raid here, a raid there, 20 people there, maybe 100 people here, 50 people over there. It's nothing. It's like a joke. Is that even more than Obama? I doubt it, because we don't have official numbers. I don't see official statistics.
Are there any other science fiction novels or science fiction films that you would say capture archaic futurism? You mentioned Starship Troopers.
Yeah, Starship Troopers. I was talking about it with a friend of mine the other day.
And I think you also showed me an old Soviet film from the 20s or 30s.
Yeah, it was Alita.
Alita.
Yeah, but based on a Soviet novel, it's about... Well, basically, it's about a proletarian revolution on Mars. It's like you have some scientists here on Earth, and the scientist has sort of like a dream, and he dreams that there's like some society on Mars where, like, sort of like, I would say, similar to, like, sort of similar to what Guillaume Fay describes in Archaea Futurism, that you have sort of like an elite who lives in luxury, who has everything, who lives on the surface of the planet, but then you have like an underclass of workers that basically toil in caves underground to support the lifestyle of the rich. Well, not exactly like Phi, but the point is it's also like a two-class society. But since it was a Soviet novel and then later on a Soviet film, of course you have sort of like a proletarian Martian revolution and they sort of like overthrow the aristocrats, the ruling class, and make the Red Planet a proletarian Red Planet, according to Soviet ideology. Which is, in my opinion, what would also happen if Guillaume Fay's society or two-class society ever came into existence, because you'd also have a revolution and then it would also be class-based, because it is a two-class society. Therefore, I reject the notion. Starship Troopers, of course, I'm sure everybody's seen it. It's the idea. Humanity is united because humanity has a common enemy, the bugs, the insectoid race that threatens Earth, even though the humanity sort of started the war. But that's like not the point. But now humanity is united to crush the enemy, the insect enemy. But the interesting idea is that you're only allowed to be a citizen, a productive citizen of the state, if you've served in the military. You can only vote if you've served in the military, because then you have a stake in society. And yeah, I'm not sure if that should be reintroduced as well.
Yeah,
only
one thing
people
that's
who serve to be able to vote.
One thing that's interesting about Heinlein is he was a critic of mass democracy. I'm very critical of democracy, but at the same time, I don't want a dictatorship or monarchy either. I think the best solution is to have a democracy, but there's some kind of screening process that prevents just the kind of the conformist masses from voting. So either there's different proposals, but Heinlein is saying either some kind of civic service to prove that you're worthy of voting.
Right,
yeah.
Heinlein wasn't just talking about military service. It was civil service. I mean, maybe in the film version, it's all military. But Heinlein later clarified that he meant civil service, that you had to be part of the civil service in some way, and that could include military or it could include some other kind of civil service, but just something that you had a stake in the society that you were in order to have a say. Or to kind of to prove that you cared about something greater than yourself. I think that's what he was kind of getting at. And I wrote an article a couple of years ago on Starship Troopers on my old blog.
Yeah, we actually did a whole show on that on Heinlein.
Yeah, and that was kind of about that. And I also was a big fan of it because it was kind of like the movie was intended to be a parody, like making fun of fascism, but it was kind of like it was a good argument for it, because you watch it and you're like, oh, actually that society looks like it works pretty well, it looks pretty great, like I would want to live in it. And then it's also interesting because Heinlein, where I always identify with him is that he was a futurist, but he didn't and his like the quote like his kind of tendencies toward fascism, they weren't like the other kind of neo-Nazi types that you see, where they're mixed with all this other crap like sexual puritanism and traditionalism and things like that. Heinlein kind of mixed his fascist tendencies with more of a sexually open society and a little bit more. It wasn't like this huge like reactionary radical traditionalist kind of mindset.
Would you say pretty close to what Roger Blackstone advocates?
Right, of course.
Yeah, hold on a second. That reminds me that, again. Sorry, like I don't know if you've read Norman Lowell's *Imperium Europa*. I mentioned it earlier today, earlier before.
I'm familiar with it. I haven't read it.
Anyway, but he pretty, what you just said with Heinlein's like idea of a fascist society which doesn't have these weird sexual hang-ups and homophobia and all this nonsense, like
right.
Norman Lowell says the same thing. Like he envisions also sort of like a fascist sort of society, again like a pan-European society, the European Empire. But he says it's like you have to differentiate between imperium and dominium. And he says, like, on an Imperium level, which is like what the Empire showed itself to be to the outside world, it should be ruthless, strict, should be completely defensive, and should tolerate no invaders. The border should be secured, should portray strength, and so on. But inside the Empire, you would have Dominium, which is sort of like a liberal society where everything should be legal, including drugs like heroin, cocaine, prostitution. Everything should be legal because it's all about individual responsibility. So it's sort of like a libertarian, like racialism, so to speak, because it would be like an all-white society according to Lowell. Like only Europeans would be allowed to reside within the Empire, but they would have all the rights, basically, like any libertarian could dream of, like drugs, guns, prostitutes, everything.
Are you generally...
Because it's all your choice.
Are you generally libertarian when it comes to those issues like homosexuality and drug use and prostitution?
Yeah, I would say yes, because I believe in freedom of association. So, I mean, I'm not a homophobe, so I'm not, like, opposed to homosexuality on moral grounds. And I don't really care what people do behind closed doors in the privacy of their own home. I just don't want to see it being promoted on the streets where children can watch. Like, I don't want gay parades. I just don't see the purpose in it. And it shouldn't be promoted on TV. So basically, I want homosexuals to go back into the closet, but I wouldn't, like, I don't know, like, criminalize it. So it's the same as freedom of association. Like if you don't want to hang out with these people, you're free not to do so. And the same with drugs. If you want to do drugs, you should do drugs, you know, but then you should suffer the consequences if you have any problems resulting from it. And you shouldn't depend, you shouldn't like expect the state to take care of you just because of your own bad choices, which is also what Norman Lowell says in the book, basically. So it could have a libertarian, almost like a promiscuous society, but where everybody has a choice to do what he or she wants if it doesn't hurt anybody else in the process, but at the same time suffer the consequences because the state won't help you.
So in economics, right, are you closer to capitalism or socialism?
Yeah, I would say we need a good mix of the two because capitalism is important for an incentive to progress because... In a pure socialist economy like the Soviet Union was, there's no real incentive to develop, to innovate, to come up with new ideas. And that precisely because there's no real competition, but you need competition. You need incentives, and money is an incentive for people to create new things and do new things. But at the same time, you need some sort of social system. So I would say, to help out the people in need, like I would say you need universal health care, free health care, and some sort of unemployment benefits to some extent where people who really can't find a job sort of like get some kind of assistance from the state, at least until they can find a job or the government finds a job for them or creates a job for them. So I would say like what you have in some countries in Europe now, like I would say like Scandinavia, even Germany, is not really a bad system. The problem is that these systems are too lax because they're too liberal, not libertarian, which means they're being exploited by a lot of people because the state is not strong enough and doesn't care about its own people.
In order for those kinds of countries to, those kinds of systems to work, kind of ironically, like those are the systems where you need strong immigration controls because you have to maintain that delicate balance of socialism. Whereas these hyper capitalists, like libertarian countries, like they where it's every man for himself, then like you could see why those would be more open to immigration. But if you were like a socialist country, you would have to have a delicate balance of like how many people are there and who's contributing what, and you'd have to keep track of that in order for it to function effectively.
Well, and also, in the future, automation and artificial intelligence are going to have a major impact on these issues.
Yeah.
I think so. Well, a lot of people have to find new jobs, but new jobs will be created because, I don't know, I think I watched a documentary like Amazon opened a supermarket in Los Angeles. Robert, have you heard of this?
Oh yeah, I've seen that. I think it's in Seattle.
I thought it was Los Angeles. No, like, oh, maybe Seattle.
Maybe
I'm not
two
sure,
of them.
but it was like, there's no transaction anymore. Like, you don't have cashiers, but you also don't have like some credit card terminal. Basically, you just walk in, you pick up the product, and walk out, and it's somehow automatically deducted from your account, but without any kind of transaction in the supermarket itself.
Yeah, it just like knows who you are somehow. Like,
yeah, somehow like something. Right? I saw it on BBC the other day, but. I think that's the future anyway, because I don't see the point of like standing in line in the supermarket waiting 10 minutes to be served by a cashier if they're really slow and everything. And even if you don't have a human cashier, then you still have these credit card terminals where you still have to swipe and type and so on, you know, and it's all a waste of time really. So I think like a supermarket lakes, you just walk in, pick up the food, walk out, that's it. Of course, a lot of people lose jobs, but the same is true with bus drivers, I would say, like subway drivers, train drivers, etc.
So it'll basically eliminate a lot of the lower skilled level jobs, but it'll create more jobs in scientific fields.
Yeah, because new jobs will be created because, like you said, a lot of new fields will spring up. Yeah, we'll just shift, I suppose. Or you could do...
Yeah, and it also offsets people... having less children, right? Like you don't necessarily need as many people, which is another reason why having this mass immigration is going to ruin a lot of that, because you're bringing in these masses of people rather than letting the situation balance itself, where people have less children, but then they have more space, and then at some point it kind of evens out, you know?
Yeah, that's why I don't understand. Like, a lot of say, like the white nationalist types, they always say like whites need to make more babies, but I'm not sure if that's even a good idea, because like we can never keep up in terms of numbers anyway, even if you do make more babies. It's not really about quantity. I think it's just more about quality is more important.
Yeah, and it's ultimately it's a distraction, because we're not going to beat the opposition by out-humping them. Like, that's their best game. Like, the West became great because it was more innovative than these other areas, and that's what and those are the strengths that we need to play to. So the goal is, it shouldn't be how to out-hump them, but really how to separate ourselves from them in a way we're able to thrive.
Not out-hump, but out-smart, you know? So basically...
Right.
We need to make, instead of making more babies, you need to have a better educated people, because you have a lot of like whites, but they're very low quality whites, you know. It's like they really serve no constructive purpose.
Are you saying there are some segments of the population that we need more of?
Well, I would say we need more scientists, engineers, and definitely, yes. Like hard sciences, people who can actually create things and aid in the process of technological advancement, because that's the future anyway. So like while in the US they're debating, I don't know, whether teachers should carry guns or teachers shouldn't carry guns, because I don't know, Starfleet officers, did they carry phasers? I don't know. But the Chinese, all they worry about is how many more hundreds of miles of high-speed train tracks are we going to build today, and how far is our AI project going along? That's what the Chinese care about, and that's why the Chinese will beat us, because I don't see this kind of like infrastructure development in the West that you see in China, because they have the right priorities, and they're sort of like, I would say, it's very racially or at least ethnically minded, and they really care about their people and how their people will progress and advance in the future.
That's
while
one
I don't
thing
see it,
is when you
it.
When you have a homogenous society like Japan, people are willing to invest in infrastructure. One thing I've noticed about conservatives in America, they associate mass transit with minority groups, so they're not willing to invest in infrastructure for things like rail and subways.
Yeah, yeah, it's very sad, but I guess in America it's true, because, like, I mean, I lived in America a while, and if you take the Greyhound bus, and, it is minorities, or, I don't know, junkies, basically, that take the Greyhound bus, or just very poor people, because normal people in the US have a car, and if you don't have a car, if you take the Greyhound bus, there's something wrong with you, basically, I mean, according to American standards. And I think that's the reason why you don't have like high speed trains like you have in China. In the U.S., it's just not feasible. But didn't they want to build one in California?
Yeah, they're building one in California.
It's already costing billions and billions of dollars. And they're saying that nobody's ever going to ride it when it's finished, and it's all a complete failure, and it's all like, I don't know, money flushed down the toilet, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. Like, I support those kind of projects, but I can see where people come from, because riding the subway in Los Angeles, I mean, it's disgusting. It's just like, I mean, riding on there will not only make you a racist, like if you're at all observant, but it'll also make you like a misanthrope if you ride the subway. So it's kind of, it's just so,
yeah,
like,
I got
dreary,
my wallet,
like,
I got my wallet stolen in the LA subway system.
Right, and it just smells like piss. It's just disgusting. Like, and it's like, maybe if you were in Japan and you could ride transit with like Japanese people, maybe you'd be like, oh, this is wonderful. Like, this is like elevated civilization.
Yeah, I've ridden the subway in Tokyo. It's very civilized. Like, people are very well behaved. Like, no nonsense. Yeah, and it's just very overcrowded. I think the Tokyo subway system is the most crowded in the world, and there are these special people on the outside who wear white gloves, whose only job is to push people in so more people can fit into the car. But yeah, other than that, yeah, it's very nice. Same in Moscow, where I live now. Like, I would say Moscow is not that homogenous, but still, like, it's completely civilized. Like, you don't see any, no subway ride in Western Europe, in any West European city or in any American cities as civilized as Moscow. So, everybody's very quiet, well-behaved, you know. Even the minority groups don't act up, but I suppose because they know they're in a minority and Russians don't take that shit. And
well, yeah, Anatoly Karelin wrote that the minority groups in Russia, including the Central Asian Muslims, are much better, much more civilized than the groups in Western Europe.
Yeah, they don't act. You almost never see them acting up, like in the subway or on the street, because they know they would immediately be beaten by the Russians standing next to them. Something that would never happen in, say, Germany, for example, where a bunch of drunk Turks, basically acting like hooligans on the subway train, can do whatever they want, and all the Germans are cowered into silence, and everybody's afraid to do anything. Not the same in London, I suppose.
As far as architecture and aesthetics go, is there an architectural style that best captures archaic futurism?
It's a good question. I would say, like, in Moscow, you see a lot of, like, beautiful new buildings, which are very functional, that also use a lot of, like, glass and steel, but sort of have a very, it's almost like a classical facade on the outside that integrates well with the 19th century buildings that you see all around them, which are still intact, so they sort of blend in. So I would say it's different than, say, Western Europe, or even in the United States, where they build a lot of like gigantic skyscrapers, but sort of just like blocks, basically. And in between, you still have these 19th, 18th century buildings, but they don't really match well together. I would say in Russia they're paying more attention to the outside and to the aesthetics, so they sort of blend in, even though they're very modern looking, but at the same time very traditional.
Yeah, because I've noticed a lot of radical traditionalist types, like, they really hate skyscrapers and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't hate skyscrapers at all. Like, I think skyscrapers are perfectly fine. Just depends how they look. Like, for example, in Moscow, you have what are called the Stalin's Seven Sisters, which are these neo-Gothic skyscrapers that Stalin had built in the 1930s to the 1950s, like seven of them. But now in Moscow, they build two new skyscrapers, but which are not as ornamental as these neo-Gothic ones that Stalin had built. But, like, just from the outline, from the basic shape, they are basically very, very similar, so they blend into the skyline perfectly well.
What do you think about the Soviet retrofuturism and some of those illustrations of Soviet space age illustrations?
Yeah, I like them a lot, and I always post them in my Facebook group all the time. Yeah, I think they're done by communists, and communists who are always, like, full of hope for mankind. They're very optimistic, and like I would say never dystopian like in the West, always really utopian of how glorious it will be, especially for the common man in terms of mode of transport and living conditions and fields and I don't know, happy workers dancing down a beautiful pedestrian street while the cars hover overhead.
Yeah, that's what I don't really get about conspiracy theorists. Conspiracy theorists have this idea that the elites are these grandiose utopians, but I think that the biggest problem with Western civilization, especially the United States, is we lack any kind of a grand utopian visions, either in the direction of our civilization or as far as building cities.
Yeah, because there is no vision anymore, because the elites don't care about the people anymore. Therefore, they don't care about society. It's all about enriching themselves and becoming part of what is called the global community. They have no interest in their nation anymore and the people that make up the nation. And that's the problem, you know. It's like, because you have hate speech laws, hate crime laws. People can't say what they really want to say, what they really think. At the same time, they're forcing all these people on the people, inviting these people in, foreign races by the millions, to replace their own people. So how can they be like a unified vision or a grand vision if there's no concern for your people anymore at all? Well, let's say in Russia, for example, I would say the Russian government like still cares about its people and still wants to continue sort of like a specific Russian legacy, also in terms of architecture and city planning and everything else, and media like movies, historic movies that are not always, that are not, because in the West, if you have any kind of historic film about, say, the 18th century, 19th century, even the 16th century, it's always critical. The white man is evil. It's about slavery and how it was exploitative towards other races, etc., colonialism. But the Russians don't have this hang-up, so they can make movies about the history where they themselves are portrayed as the good guys and not always as the mean, evil, terrible exploiters like they are in the West. So it's sort of like a healthy attitude to your own people that still exists in Russia. And I think it also existed, say, in America, I would say, until the 1950s, or at least until the 1960s, with John Wayne movies and so on. But then it was slowly being subverted, and now you can't have any movie about the Wild West anymore without the good Indian and the evil white guy and maybe the poor enslaved black guy.
So to kind of summarize the show, the key concept of archaeofuturism is to go forward and to have grand futuristic visions, but also to take the best aspects of ancient cultures and the best aspects of tradition.
Exactly. Completely agree.
Constantine, do you have any upcoming projects?
Yeah, I'm going to give a speech in 2 weeks in Germany about the topic of Euro-Siberia and archaeofuturism. Actually, I'm supposed to debate with a guy who's going to defend Alexander Dugin and the whole Eurasian concept. And then another guy will be there who's going to defend the whole idea of, white ethnic enclaves, some white societies that should be created now, not necessarily white nations. So just like enclaves somehow, like healthy enclaves, because we can't save our nations, we need some kind of territory somewhere. So it's basically three views: Eurasia, Euro-Siberia versus white enclaves. And it's going to be like a debate round, basically. It's going to be in East Germany in 2 weeks. I'm planning to publish a book very soon, a compilation of my writings of the past almost 20 years. I don't know, with commentary. We'll see how that'll go. And maybe publish a book together with two German guys about the German alt-right in the German language, where I will translate a bunch of my English stuff and maybe write original material in German for this book, which will be like sort of like the introduction to the German alt-right. Yes, will hopefully be also published this year. That's it.
Constantine von Hofmeister, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for inviting me. I greatly enjoyed it.
And also, thanks, Brandon Adamson.
Thanks, guys.